Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the deeply intertwined destinies of the United States and Mexico. We'll spend this hour with Dallas Morning News Mexico border correspondent Alfredo Corchado. He has spent much of his career exploring the ways these two countries have been locked in a centuries-long embrace, one that can be viewed as an abrazo, a hug, or as a kind of wrestling hold, depending on your perspective. We'll talk about how Corchado's ties to both sides have shaped his personal and professional life, and about his identity as what his longtime partner, also a border journalist, calls a combination person. Our conversation starts after this short break. The Boundary Treaty of 1970 cleared up all the remaining territory disputes between the United States and Mexico. And yet, if you understand the border as not just a dividing line, but a phenomenon, a thing that happens where two cultures intersect, you realize the border has indeed changed since that international agreement between two neighbor nations. The borderland has engulfed all of Texas and beyond. Its influence reaches Philadelphia, Wisconsin, Washington State. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Alfredo Corchado is Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. As we'll hear, he's devoted his professional life to documenting the complex relationship between the United States and Mexico, and it has taken him far afield of the geographic dividing line. His new book is called Homeland: Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo, welcome back to Think.
Chris, it's a pleasure to be back here in Dallas.
So since we'll be talking about the border today, we have to start with what is possibly the most contentious issue at the present moment, the separation of parents and children after families are caught crossing the border without prior authorization. Now, some have wished to apply for asylum. Some, I gather, are economic migrants or they're here for other reasons. What is your sense of why this is happening now?
I was in Tornillo yesterday on Sunday in El Paso, Tornillo. Asking that very question, and something that always comes up is President Trump can't get his wall, so he's going to go after migrants, and in this case, children. So there is that general sense that if you can't build the wall, you're going to try to come up with Plan B or something else. Last month, Attorney General Sessions made the announcement. They've tried to backpedal, but in reality, more than 2,000 families have been separated. The march in Tornillo was to protest this, and there's at least 200 minors. We're not really sure yet the ages. They're saying children, young teens, but we know, at least we've been told by authorities, at least 200 are being housed, and as many capacity for as many as 4,000 people in the coming weeks. Days or weeks.
But thus far, they're not letting journalists into the facility.
No, they haven't provided much access, and it's been really hard to get information as of now. It's almost like they're trying to figure things out day by day. I mean, it's a really evolving story, and I mean, it was hard to imagine the turnout that I saw yesterday. I mean, this was in response to a tweet by U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who put out a tweet on Saturday morning, and we thought, okay, you know, we can't really get information. We're not really sure what's going on. Let's go. It's Father's Day. It's the World Cup, Mexico versus Germany. I had my doubts as to, you know, what kind of a turnout it would be, but there was a sea of vehicles. I mean, there was a sea of people, and people from all walks of life. I'm hoping that in the coming days we can get much more information and maybe even access to the what they refer to as a tent city, which is really the migrant shelters.
You and I are both from that part of the country. It's very, very hot this time of
year.
Very
beautiful, too.
It's very, very beautiful as well. Is there adequate cooling at
the
facilities?
We're told that they have air conditioning. They will have air conditioning. And, you know, we were told also by some of the human rights activists and immigrant rights activists that the facility was used during the surge in 2015. And they say it's a pretty good facility. So I think they feel that that there will be decent conditions. But the question is, you know, how do you separate families? I mean, how do you separate children from their parents? That didn't happen before, and now it's happening. And that's really the, I think, the moral question. And that's something that a lot of people were asking, you know, yesterday, is what does this say about the values of this country and who we are today as a nation?
It's really turned out to be a divisive issue within the Republican Party in particular.
Yes. And I think, you know, the having Attorney General Sessions come out and use a biblical passage really offended a lot of religious leaders, conservatives. We've seen the response from the former First Lady, Laura Bush, and even the current First Lady, Melania Trump. It's a passionate issue. I mean, that's I think, what I walked away from yesterday's march was the passion, the sense of outrage that we're seeing, the sense of frustration from both sides.
The one thing I'm having trouble understanding is why these children, at least some of them, are being reclassified as unaccompanied minors when, in fact, they arrive with parents or some other family guardian.
Right. I mean, they come in and then they're saying they were checking their parents' background, and some of them are reportedly being separated. It's again, it's that kind of information that at least me as a reporter, I'm trying to get more access to. There's so much confusion. I mean, I will tell you, you being from the border, when you cross Juarez to El Paso, you go through customs. But these days, when I walk from Juarez to El Paso, there's one line, I mean, right on top of the bridge, of the international bridge, a couple of agents checking. And they're not really, I mean, I think they're more like looking for a certain description of people, and usually Central Americans. And then they will go up to them and they will question them. And we're told by human rights activists that they will say, you know, we're full today, we're at capacity, go back, or they might be separated.
Is that a thing, that they're at capacity to let people cross the border and declare?
That's the claim. That's the claim. And I mean, again, you know, it's a really evolving story, and we're trying to get more information. But there's so many agencies involved, and everyone, I think, is trying to sort of pass the buck to one another.
All right. On to your very interesting book. It's a memoir of your life and your career. It's also a story of friends who've taken their own paths to really defining themselves as people who were tied to Mexico and also the United States. You had a roundabout path, first of all, to journalism. You dropped out of high school, which I didn't know about you, and this is really fascinating. You went on to complete your education. How did you realize you wanted to write for a living?
I was out in the fields.
Agricultural
fields in California. We came to the United States in 1966, and my parents were members of the United Farm Workers Union. And we didn't have babysitters, so oftentimes we would spend part of our time in the fields, weekends, summers. And one day, these journalists come up, and they're looking for people who are sort of breaking the law. I mean, it was at the time, it was, I think you had to be 15 years old to be working out in the fields. I was 13. My mother would put on the big shirt and the big hat and try to make me look older. And journalists, I still believe, are pretty perceptive, you know. And they came up to me and asked me, how old are you? I think that was the first question, you know, how old are you? And I said, 13. So right away, you know, they had their story. My mother was horrified that we were breaking the law, and that or the ordinance, and that Cesar Chavez would really be ticked off, and that maybe we would even be deported. I mean, we had green cards at the time. But I walked away thinking, wow, these people want to tell my story. That's interesting. You know, and I dropped out of high school, I mean, you know, shortly after. But my mother bribed me to get back to school. I left the fields of California, and ended up in El Paso, went to community college. And for extra credit, my English teacher said, you know, maybe you want to work at the student newspaper. I think a week later, I was named features editor, not because I was good, but because there was no one else who wanted the job, or they had no one else to recruit. But once you get that disease of journalism, it's incurable. And especially when you're on the laboratory of the border. I mean, when you're watching two countries you had all these protests in Ciudad Juarez. I mean, this was a time of the democratic movement in Mexico. That was a citizens' movement. So imagine a kid who grew up in the San Joaquin Valley in California, and suddenly you're on the border and you're watching this, and the whole impact of immigration. I mean, all these factors, you know, they come into play right on the border, and you're right there covering it for a student newspaper. But that led to other things.
It's an extraordinary leap to go from the El Paso Herald Post, may it rest in peace, to the Wall Street Journal. You went on to prove to yourself and to everybody else that you belonged at the Journal. But it sounds like when you first got to Philadelphia, which is where the office was that you were working out of, you didn't feel confident.
Not at all. I questioned myself as to what was I doing in Philadelphia? Why did I leave the border? Why did I leave the Southwest? My mother told me a really interesting story. You know, when the Wall Street Journal guy, I had turned him down for like 6 months. I kept saying, yeah, yes, maybe, you know. And he finally flies to El Paso, and he's thinking, you know, I think he doesn't want to come because of his family. He's too attached to his family. I'm the oldest of nine. And after he makes his pitch, my parents say, sure, you know, let him go. But I kept telling my mother, you know, I don't have to leave. I want to be on the border. I want to be here. And my mother said, maybe that's the way things have to be. Your father left Mexico to be a guest worker, and he didn't want to leave, but that's what destiny. She said, maybe this is your destiny. You want to be a writer. This man seems to care for you and wants to help you. And I thought, as I left El Paso, I thought, you know, my father went to work the fields of California, of Arizona, of New Mexico, Texas. I saw it as a journey to try to tell their stories and tell our story. And I think that's really what guided me. But when I arrived in Philadelphia, I knew nothing. I mean, I felt, I called a source in El Paso who said, you might be in luck. There might be one Mexican in Philadelphia. Gave me the number. And through this person, Primitivo Rodriguez, began sort of the journey of trying to find out whether there was more than two Mexicans in that region.
There were at least four, as the book goes on to detail. Of course, there were more. But you started hanging out at this restaurant called Tequila's, which I can't even imagine for a kid from Mexico and then the border, what low expectations you had for a Mexican restaurant in Philadelphia.
I was very skeptical. I mean, I'm now covering corporate America, if you will, for the Wall Street Journal, and learning about marketing and so forth. And I'm really, really suspicious. If we walk into this restaurant, and you see the iconic Virgin of Guadalupe, you see Fidel Castro, I mean, portrait of Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Emiliano Zapata, and I'm thinking, God, these marketing people think of everything, don't they? And we walk upstairs, and there's music playing, music from Mecano, Cruz de Navaja, and I'm thinking, they even got the music down. And the smell, my parents had a restaurant in El Paso called Freddy's Cafe, and so, you know, I could pick up the smell, and I thought, this is really authentic. But I still was suspicious. So we're sitting down, and Primitivo and I are speaking in Spanish to each other. We're poking fun at everything. We're, you know, questioning everything. And the guy at behind the bar is the bartender. But I keep thinking, mate, he's got to be Italian. Turns out he was David Suro from Guadalajara. So all these little things, you know, I say in the book, I think I became more Mexican because of Philadelphia than I would have been in El Paso, because I think David was able to sort of create the perfect little Mexico through that one restaurant, Tequila's.
And it was this place that sparked a lot of conversations about what it meant to be Mexican and also American.
We spent a lot of hours. I think I later tallied up my tab, and I realized I was spending maybe half my paycheck at Tequila's. which is not good for a first-year reporter. But yeah, I think that's really where we all came together, and we supported each other and became a community.
Alfredo Corchado is a journalist, Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, Alfredo Corchado. He is a journalist and Mexican border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. His new memoir is called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I want to go to some history. Before 1882 in this country, there were no rules about immigration. So anybody could enter the country and stay here?
Pretty much. And then, I think it's an issue that really resonates today when people say, you know, you have to come in legally. My relatives, my ancestors came through legally. Well, yes. I mean, there wasn't really, I mean, the Border Patrol didn't come out till the 1920s. But it was a lot more flexible. It was a lot more lax. You know, one thing that's, when you talk about history, is that Mexicans have always sort of been the exception. There's either a way to scapegoat them, or there's a way, or there's always demand for them. You either deport them, or you lure them back. And it's something that's happened from the 1800s, early 1900s to the present.
You talk about the need that many employers seem to have for Mexican workers from before the time of the Bracero program.
During World War I, I mean, there was another labor program that lured many, many Mexicans to the United States. I mean, one of the things that was interesting researching this book was looking at the number of Mexicans who were already living throughout the U.S., you know, whether it was Ohio, whether it was Michigan, many of them trace their roots back to the Ford Company, for example. So there was already kind of a significant migration, and that tells you that the demand was already there. I mean, the demand has been there for generations. Obviously, things change over the years as demand grew. And the country needed more workers, and the economy continued to grow. I mean, to the point where, even though you had workers, you still needed many, many more of them to keep up.
The first immigration law we did have in this country was designed to keep people out based on race.
Right. It was more aimed at Eastern Europeans. Asians, the Chinese,
Exclusion
Exclusive
Act.
Right? But again, Mexicans were always sort of the exception.
What changed in 1965 with that Immigration Act? And what were the, I gather, unintended consequences of changing the way we did immigration in this country?
That was, you know, it's interesting because that's really where my story begins in Homelands. The Bracero program had ended. And this was between 1942 and the mid-1960s. You had more than 5 million contracts were awarded to Mexicans. The program ends, and I remember my father telling me, every time I leave, his employer would say, "I'm afraid you won't come back." And in 1965, he was able to legalize. I mean, there was a big legalization program. And the employer tells my father, "What if we just bring the whole family to the United States? What if we provide all of them green cards?" And next thing we know, we're uprooted and we leave and we end up in the United States.
What do you remember about that transition? What were you, about 5 or 6 years old at the time?
I was 5 years old when I left Durango. Mm-hmm. I was born in San Luis de Cordero, Durango, and spent a year in Ciudad Juarez as we waited for the paperwork to arrive for the green cards to arrive. What I remember the most is that I didn't really know who my father was. I know there was a man who would come every 8 months, every 7 months from California. There was a circularity pattern, if you will, where Mexicans would go to the United States for a few months and then come back home for the holidays. My father would very dutifully stop in El Paso from the San Joaquin Valley, stop at Tony Lama's, buy some boots, and then take them back. And I remember it was, you know, I didn't call him Papa. I would call him Señor or Oiga Usted. And he sent this postcard from California when we were getting ready to make the big trip. And it was, I remember the postcard of the state capitol and thinking and trying to tell my brothers, because none of us really wanted to leave for the U.S. I mean, we were all really afraid. But telling my brothers, this is going to be great. You know, this is what the America looks like. This is what our home will look like. And it was a state capitol. And I remember on that Greyhound bus, you know, at every little community, every little town we stopped by, my brothers would ask, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I would pull the card. I'd say, no, but
doesn't
I think we're
like
getting
that close.
We're getting close. It was obviously a big disappointment because we ended up living, our first few houses were migrant camps out in the middle of the fields.
And you were living in a trailer early on.
We were living in a trailer house, the first one where my uncles were living. I mean, it was a small little trailer house where my brothers and I and my uncles were sleeping outside. There was always concern that about rats, you know, at night. It was summertime, so it was really hot. My parents were inside, but that was the, I guess, the typical migrant story, you know, where you arrive, you're farm workers, and you lived out in the fields, and then you slowly, you know, pick your way up.
So your parents are super entrepreneurial. They started this little cafe that is kind of legendary along the border, and it's the sort of place that you had, at least back in the 80s, you know, Border Patrol agents eating next to farm workers, eating next to business people.
And next to smugglers.
Next to smugglers.
And undocumented people. I mean, it was always for someone at my age at the time, you know, I was starting out to be a reporter. This was a great place for sourcing. And it was, I'm the waiter, so I'm taking everybody's order, and I'm talking to the customs person. I'm talking to the Border Patrol agent, and I'm talking to the customer who just smuggled in some... because back in the day, I mean, this is before NAFTA. I mean, you had to smuggle
electronics
from El Paso to Juarez, bring wine from Juarez to El Paso. You had all the kinds of merchants going back and forth. I mean, all kinds of activity going back and forth. So in one lunch hour or breakfast hour, I mean, you were able to meet people from all walks of life.
So ultimately, the Wall Street Journal said, why don't you go back to Freddy's Cafe for a few months and do something about the climate there?
And I think that was my big change. I mean, that was my big turnaround. When you ask yourself, you know, what am I doing here? And my editor at the time, I mean, the bureau chief, Frank Allen, saw something that I didn't see. He said, you know, I need people. We need people like you. Journalism needs people like you from... diversity from all walks of life, because this country is changing. And I didn't know what he meant. There was a time where I thought about leaving the journal and just going home. But he said there's this Immigration Reform Act, and we're trying to figure out what's going on in people's minds. I mean, how do people feel about that? What do you think about going back home and being the waiter and asking people questions, you know, do a first person story. And that, I think that's when it hit me, you know, what the importance of his decision to hire me and how I could play a role and how I could hopefully become a bridge of understanding between both countries and try to, through the writing, through the reporting, make people on both sides understand one another a little better.
Years later, something that occurred to you was that the border didn't just exist on the border anymore. There was, as you say it, like another Mexico growing inside the United States. Talk about that.
By now, I'm working for the Dallas Morning News, and one of the big projects they had set in mind was to go across the country and figure out the reshaping of America. What was happening throughout America? I think it's safe to say that the Immigration Reform Act of 86 legalized something like 2.7 million people. But then you also began, it didn't quell, it didn't end the demand for workers. So you had, suddenly you had more families coming in, and you had more and more people coming in through them. I mean, I'll tell you a quick story that's always sort of stayed in my mind. When I left Mexico, I thought I would never see my relatives again or my family again because they were left behind. And my mother said, you know, every afternoon we're hanging out by the trailer houses and the farmers would show up and say, can you spread the word? We need more workers. And so all of a sudden, all my relatives, my family, my friends, they're right there next to me in California. This really is what happened in the 80s and the 90s, is that more and more people came, not so much because they wanted to, as much as the demand was there, and also the circular pattern was closing. The more security you created, the harder it was for people to go back and forth. And so what I saw as a reporter traveling these communities was seeing more and more little small San Joaquin valleys popping up along the country. And underneath the surface, sort of a simmering tension. I mean, I remember traveling to Wisconsin and other places, and people back then, you know, you're trying to get a hotel room and people asking for your citizenship papers. And I'm thinking to myself, I work for the Wall Street Journal. I have an American Express card.
Right.
Or later on, you know, I'm a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. But I think that was always sort of there.
Yeah. And there's also the reality that after 1986, people started moving to other parts of the country. So there have always been Mexican immigrants living in California and Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. Maybe the thing that some people in some parts of the country find alarming is that this immigration is no longer limited to border regions.
Right. I mean, and that was in large part to 1987. But again, I mean, I'm living in Philadelphia in 1986, 87, and I use the word in quotes, discover a little town called Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, where for years the most of the workforce had been from Guanajuato and Michoacán. They were undocumented. I mean, they didn't have papers, and they lived sort of in the fringes of society, but they were there. And what happened, I think Kennett Square is a really good example of what's happening across the country. I mean, the initial response from the community was, especially after IRCA, after the amnesty, was so many Mexicans came up that there was an outcry from the community, you know, pushing back or tell them they're not welcome. They took yellow ribbons around and placed them as a sign of you're not welcome here. And then it later dawned on them that this is really the story of the country, the story of the United States. And people started to realize, you know, this is our economic force. We're here because of the mushroom industry. I think Kennett Square is sort of an example today of the reconciliation of a community. Is you know, we're here, we have to do more to try to get along and try to become one community. I was just there recently, and it's now something like half of the population is from Mexico. But you don't see that kinds of tensions that we now see in other parts of the country.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Can you talk about the idea that you and your friends were all navigating different identities? You wrote about your friend Ken, who born and raised in New Mexico, of Mexican descent, but his people had been in what is now New Mexico for centuries, and he wasn't quite sure what that meant to who he was. You call him sort of the ambassador of mainstream American culture in your little foursome.
Right. Ken was the only non-Mexican, but as he argues with us, he was more Mexican than the three of us. And Ken was looking for his Mexican roots. I mean, we were looking for the mainstream of America, but he was looking to find a way to rediscover his culture, his language. He would practice his Spanish with us at night and learn to drink a lot of tequila with us. but it was, I mean, it's really a book about the universal theme of friendship and family and Ken embodies the other Mexico that's always been in the United States, you know, the New Mexico and other parts of the country, other regions.
You call yourself in the book Pocho, and this surprised me because you're a native Spanish speaker. But for people who don't know the term, what does it mean and what did it mean to you when you felt like you were a Pocho when you returned to Mexico as an adult?
It meant you have been bleached by the American ways. It means assimilation. I mean, I came to the United States, didn't speak a word of English. And suddenly you begin to lose that, even though Spanish has always been my first language at home. But you begin to lose that that native tongue feel to things. I mean, I think Mexican music has always sort of kept me together. But when you leave for Philadelphia and you're trying to fit in, you sort of lose it more and more. I mean, in my own family today, second generation, I'm hard pressed to find anyone to really speak Spanish with, you know, or for my parents to speak Spanish with. But it was really assimilation. When I first heard the term, it made me feel like I was really not from anywhere, you know, because I try so hard to keep my roots, my culture, and when you're told you're being bleached, you're not really sure what you become. What does that mean? I mean, when they stop the dryer, what will the final product look like? So when I later become a correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, and that I think that's when the term really hit me, and it really made me feel like, you know, for years I had been nostalgic about going back home, about being part of Mexico and part of its culture, and suddenly you're the outsider, you're the pocho. I think that sentiment, because of the powerful economic, political, cultural forces that we've seen in the last few years, I think that term is slowly fading. You don't hear it as much because there's so much English in Mexico and there's so much Spanish in the United States. I think the Mexican government is now trying to figure out, you know, what do we call them? And they're not really pochos. And I think they've done a pretty good job so far of eliminating that term.
My guest is journalist Alfredo Corchado. He is Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and author of a new book called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Alfredo Corchado. He is Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK, or you can email think at KERA.org. I mean, no disrespect to the Wall Street Journal whatsoever. You're now working for the Dallas Morning News. I wonder if a Texas institution understands better that there is a lot of nuance in issues of borders and immigration than a national publication. Was the Journal ever looking for you to sort of retell maybe the expected narrative?
I think that was my first editor's vision. And even on through the years, I mean, George Getchow was my last editor. He now lives in the Dallas area. But that was the vision, was that the importance of Mexico throughout the United States. I mean, again, these economic forces that were reshaping both countries. But certainly no one really gets it as much as, say, a Texas institution. Because no one has more to lose. No one has experienced it more. No one knows it better than, say, Texas and Mexico. California, yes, it's very important. But I mean, when you look at trade, when you look at at people going back and forth. It's a 2,000-mile border. About 1,000 miles is along the Texas area or region. So there, I think the stakes are higher, and I certainly feel, you know, a bigger sense of a responsibility, obligation to tell it from both sides. I mean, from the Mexican side and from the Texan side. And oftentimes you feel like you're navigating two countries.
Do you foresee a future in which people of Mexican and Central American heritage are viewed as equally American as people who came from Italy and Ireland originally?
I really have a hard time with that question. I think there are moments. I mean, I think one of the things I say in the book is that there's always that cruel irony that the moment when you feel you've found the mainstream, the questions begin all over again. But when I look at my own family and I look at our own history and I see the assimilation that's taken place and the acceptance that they're receiving, I think we're marching towards that. It's not a pretty march. There's a lot of conflicts, as we've seen. There's a lot of tensions. But I do see the day when we're much more intertwine, if you will. I don't know that we will be the Irish or the Italians, because I think when you leave an ocean behind, it's a whole different dynamic than when the border is right there staring at you every day, and it's right. I mean, it's a 2,000-mile border, and it's. But yet at the same time, I mean, when I'm reporting in Mexico, I see the American influence there. And I think there are a lot of Mexicans who ask themselves the very same question, what's happening to our country? Why does it feel and look more and more American? It's the same dynamic that's taken place on both sides.
Surely that's more intense along the border. I wonder if you can describe what people in Mexico City think about people in a city like Juarez. Do they see Juarez as being completely infiltrated by U.S. culture?
Yes. Yes, I do. But I mean, the very same things that we're seeing in Juarez, we're seeing in Mexico City, we're seeing in central Mexico. I mean, large U.S. corporations, franchises.
Walmart, KFC.
Walmart, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I can't leave my apartment in La Condesa without running into a Starbucks. but all these things, I think, are reshaping the way people think of each other. And it used to be that Juarez was, you know, they're so far, they're so close to the United States, they're almost gringo. I mean, they're almost American. And I think there's like a new appreciation among a lot of Mexicans who now see them as sort of the defenders, the first line of defenders, even though I don't know there's a way to defend against the influence of both sides.
It's interesting to talk about that because I think it's really easy for Americans to assume that everybody wants to be us, and that's not true of other cultures.
No, that's not true. I mean, I now spend much of my time on the U.S. side, and it's hard to go to a place and not listen to Spanish or hear Spanish music. I was just with a guitar maker in Michoacán recently, who said thanks to the Americans, we still have mariachis. He makes all these guitarrones for the market in the United States. So again, it's the influence that goes back and forth, and it's people on this side trying to keep the culture alive, and in many ways, kind of redefining their own culture, like on the Mexican side of the border.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Raimundo on the line in Austin. Hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying this interview immensely, and I always listen to your interviews. You do a fantastic job.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask Alfredo, I'm from Eagle Pass, and I have a lot of friends in El Paso, including Alfredo de los Santos, who is president of El Paso Community College. But you mentioned the word Portugal, and in living on the border and celebrating festivities in Mexico and the United States, in Mexico, we were called Portugal. In the United States, and I also migrated to California as a farm worker, and we were called Mexican. And many of us got caught between two cultures, and so we joined the Chicano movement. And you say you live at La Condesa in Mexico City. People in Mexico City, the students really embraced Chicanismo and wanted to learn from us in terms of advocating for our issues. And I was wondering how you felt about being pushed one way or the other, being a Pocho, called a Pocho in Mexico, and a Mexican over here, and nothing else.
Thanks for your call.
I think I credit, more than anything, I credit my mother for keeping me very, very sure, very secure of who I am. I always feel very Mexican, whether I'm on the Mexican side or on the U.S. side, in spite of being called a Pocho. And I think it's important to look at what the government is doing, the Mexican government. I mean, their strategy is to try to build this bridge between, they don't use the word Pochos, but between Mexican Americans and Mexico, to try to one day create sort of a soft landing for policy, for U.S. policy. So that's really kind of the bigger picture. Regardless of the term, you are, I think the vision on the Mexican side is someday you will become a much more important player between both countries.
Your girlfriend, the respected journalist Angela Cocherga, has a more positive take on it. She calls you combination people.
Combination people. And it was interesting to hear it from Angela. Because it's a term, as Raimundo put out, it's a term that sort of haunts you. But the way Angela sees it is you're really from both sides. You know, and obviously on the border, Eagle Pass or El Paso, it's a region where you really don't have to choose. You're from both sides. I mean, it's really, I always refer to the border as the epicenter of the homelands, of my homelands. But Angela is very open, very clear, and of embracing both sides, of not running away from either side, and just saying, you know, you have to feel the positive vibe that comes from being from Texas and being from the United States.
I always think not quite
Mexico.
Not quite fitting in somewhere is not necessarily a bad thing for a journalist, because you don't want to fit perfectly into a culture because you stop seeing things.
I see it as a strength. I mean, I see it as a way of really, as we saw yesterday with this march in Tornillo, Texas, it's a way of blending both sides, and it's a way of really, I think, understanding things in a much richer context. I mean, I don't see it as less or more, but in my case, I see it as much more.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Isabel on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Isabel.
Hi, how are y'all?
Very well.
Hi, Isabel.
I simply want to express my appreciation for the gentleman who's speaking. I'm a 12th generation Tejana, and so, of course, I'm taking his remarks quite personally, and I understand some of the conflicting that has been imposed by people who are not of Hispanic descent. However, I just want to remind people that we, first of all of the Homo sapiens grouping on this planet. I was educated by the Jesuits, so was my father, but in Mexico. And I really, truly believe that I just would want that other people respect all the different ethnic groups that make this USA such a wonderful country.
Thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Did you want to respond to anything that Isabel had to say?
I think Isabel's completely right. I mean, I think we spend too much time looking at labels. And in the end, we're human beings trying to make the best of an opportunity and try to become better people and at the same time contribute to the place that we live in.
Going back to what's happening in Tornillo, first of all, what does that word mean?
Tornillo is like a screw.
Going back to what's happening there, it seems like a giant problem of organization and expense for the United States government. I mean, do you know anything about how where the money is coming from to provide alternative care for kids who were taken from their families?
Well, we know it's U.S. government, it's taxpayer money, it's the Health and Human Services who are the ones who are going to be in charge. We believe, and we've been told that obviously it will be private contractors for maintenance, for I mean, all these things are still, I think, being worked out. But it, as many leaders said yesterday during the march, in the end, the policy that, that we're seeing is in the name of the American people.
How did you convince your parents? What was the justification you gave your mother for moving ahead and becoming a U.S. citizen? What did, why did you want her to do that?
I thought that my parents were always sure, like most immigrants, especially Mexican immigrants, being so close to Mexico, that they would someday go back. And it was in the 1990s, under President Zedillo, that they Mexico made this incredible move, very bold move, to accept citizenship. That you would not lose your citizenship
if you didn't have to renounce Mexico.
Right, you don't have to renounce Mexico, and or your Mexican citizenship. And when I saw that, and I saw sort of what was happening, I mean, this is a time of California and Proposition 187, the actions taken against Mexicans. I thought, you know, this will someday, this could someday happen in other parts of the country. And I just felt that my parents and my family, I mean, we needed U.S. protection. When I became a journalist and I talked to my editor about someday becoming a foreign correspondent, one of the first things he said was, you need to become a U.S. citizen. You have to, if you want to live in Mexico or live in Latin America, you have to have, you know, the U.S. protection. And I thought that was really important. My parents have been U.S. citizens since 2000. And even now, I mean, they still talk about going back to Mexico someday. But yet every election, they're the first ones to get in line and to vote, because I think they see the importance of not just being Mexican American, but the importance of participating in an election, and that's something that that I think Tornillo and other parts of the country are sort of you see the reason why. I mean, you see the importance of that.
You and I have probably even had this conversation before, but we keep thinking that the great awakening of the full force of the Latino U.S. vote will happen in the next election. What do you think?
I still have a lot of questions. I mean, I think some of the friends that I describe in Homelands, Ken Trujillo in particular, he's now a lawyer, ran for mayor 2 years ago in Philadelphia, will probably run again. He sees a much more positive outcome. I mean, he sees that that Latinos will turn out in record numbers this November. As a skeptical reporter, I want to see the numbers. I mean, I want to see that that bear in hibernation actually wake up and maybe feel maybe help the country feel the force.
Journalist Alfredo Corchado is Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and author of Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for making time
Thank
for
you,
us.
Chris. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast on our website, think.kera.org, or go to any podcast app and download it there. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.